Hello, everybody. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food on April 29th, 2014. Gosh, last week was my birthday, and now it's not. But I had a great week. A lot of great food, a lot of great vegan cake, of course. And now we just, it's just every ordinary day for me, and that's good. But let's make it special, okay? We're going to be talking to some wonderful people today who've got some great messages to share. Right now, I want to bring on my first guest. Dr. Karen Davis is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that addresses the treatment of domestic fowl in food production, science, education, entertainment, and human companionship situations. Welcome to It's All About Food, Karen.
Hi, Karen. I'm delighted to be on your show today to talk about chickens and other domesticated fowl and go vegan.
Right on. So I was at the Veggie Pride Parade in Manhattan last month, and several times I chased you around just to give you a hug and tell you that you're wonderful, but I didn't get a chance to do that, so I'm sorry.
That's okay. There were a lot of people there, which was good.
It was. It was just freezing.
Yeah, but still, there were a lot of people, and I was very impressed by the fact that so many people sat in the fold-out chairs to the speakers, despite the fact that it was cold and damp and even began to drizzle, but that's encouraging to me.
That was a really good point, and I don't remember that many people. You've been coming year after year, as I have, and that was an excellent crowd, and it was a horrifically wet, chilling day. Yeah, good point. Well, I'm glad people wanted to listen, and there are more people opening up, lifting the veil, discovering what isn't so nice going on, and we're going to talk a little bit about that right now. So your organization has a special day, International Respect for Chickens Day. Let's talk about that.
Okay, sure. Well, I started International Respect for Chickens Day May 4th, and expanded to the entire month of May in 2005. And that grew out of a radio show where a radio host kind of made fun of the idea of Mother's Day being a respect for Mother Chicken's Day. Mm. And so he was kind of friendly, but a little bit sarcastic. But anyway, I wrote to him and invited our members to write to him very respectfully, but to bring out the fact that mother hens are, in fact, paragons of the best nurturing, most protective motherhood, and that we often hear mother hens rightly being invoked as exemplars of the best and caring kind of motherhood. So the radio host actually ended up agreeing with us.
Yee-hoo!
And said, well, maybe we should create an annual Respect for Chickens Day. And I thought, yeah, that is a great idea. And United Poultry Concerns is going to do exactly that. So starting in May of 2005, we established International Respect for Chickens Day to celebrate chickens throughout the world and to protest the bleakness and the sadness of their lives in farming operations. And we invite people to do an action for chickens on or around May 4th, and we capitalize the word action. We suggest that people find a way to fit speaking for chickens, doing something positive for chickens in the course of their busy day, or setting aside a day to do something for chickens, meanwhile urging that everybody make every day Respect for Chickens Day. But to choose a day, this year it's Sunday, May 4th, thereabouts, to do such things as leaflet on a busy street corner, hold an office party or a classroom celebration, write a letter to the editor of their local newspaper, or do a radio call-in. We urge people to consider tabling at their local church or their school or shopping mall, to host a vegan open house in their neighborhood, or simply to talk to family, friends, or even complete strangers about the plight and delight of chickens and how people can help them. So that's really what International Respect for Chickens Day is all about, to really focus on what chickens go through in that terrible conditions they're living in at this very second in food production operations, and to draw people's attention to the fact that chickens are so sweet and so friendly and cheerful when they're not being abused, when they're out and about in a yard and being treated with kindness and respect. So it's those two aspects of chickenhood that we seek to draw attention to, the suffering that they endure when humans mistreat them, and the cheer that they exude when they are happy and being treated with respect and being able to be out and about in the outdoors.
Karen, humans have a long way to go in terms of treating other beings with respect. Humans have a problem treating other humans with respect. And mammals are next in line, and fowl are perceived to be so far from many people's concern, which is really unfortunate. And we have so much to learn from so many animals out there. I'm always amazed to find out the intelligence that every species has. And because we don't have it, one type of intelligence or ability, we don't appreciate it or know how to appreciate it. Now,
well, you know, we tell people that, and I tell people that, you know, we share so much with the other animals on the planet. And the more we learn about birds and water creatures and mammals, even increasingly about insects, we're learning that there is a community of sentient life, which we share, mm-hmm. whereby we have our own special abilities as different species and even as individuals, but there is so much we share in our perception of the world, our care for our families, our desire not to suffer pain and abuse, and to find joy in life. And increasingly, science is showing conclusively that chickens and other birds are as intelligent as mammals. That is not just in the strictly and exclusively cerebral sense, although that is certainly part of it, but in their whole mental repertoire, including their emotions, their sensibilities, and their cognitive ability to negotiate complex environments, to live extremely successfully in social groups. So I see that we do have a long way to go, but I'm also seeing that we are coming a long way in changing our attitudes towards other species, including birds, and that science is showing not that these birds and other animals are less than we thought, but that they are, oh, so much more than mainstream conventional thinking had thought.
You were mentioning earlier about Mother's Day and about how hens are such a great example of what mothers should be. Can you give some examples of what some hens have done that have just been amazing as mothers?
Well, yes. One important thing they do is they defend their young, and it's kind of interesting that chickens are often called cowards when, in fact, both roosters and hens are the very opposite of cowards, especially when they are parents. They both hens and roosters guard the eggs with the embryos inside. Mother hen will very carefully pick off any shell debris that is still sticking to her chicks as they are struggling out of the egg, which, of course, chickens who are being born in the huge mechanical incubators in the food industry never get to experience that loving care and helping them to emerge successfully from their shells. A mother hen, like a rooster, will fight to the death if need be if a predator is attempting to harm either the eggs or the newly hatched chicks. Mother hens are excellent guardians of their birds, and I once had a situation here at our sanctuary in Virginia where there was a mother hen. Now, what happened was we do not allow our hens to hatch eggs at our sanctuary. We gather the eggs, and we hard-boil them and feed them back to our chickens. But in one particular case, a hen jumped the 8-foot fence, disappeared, and then returned with a little group of chicks. This was a few years ago. Yeah, we thought we didn't know what had happened to her, but she was gone, and then suddenly she appeared with this little family. So one day I was sitting at the computer here looking out the window, and my computer helper was upstairs working at the computer, and she had brought her large, very, very passive and well-behaved black Labrador to stay outside in the yard while she worked upstairs. Well, so suddenly I heard all this commotion going on. This hen was just yelling and yelling at this Labrador. And so I walked outside. This was under a great big magnolia tree in the front yard. And so here's the hen. Her name was Eva. And she was just flying and flying and flying at this black Labrador, who was kind of standing there bewildered. He really wasn't doing anything, but she perceived him as a threat. And she had hidden all of her baby chicks behind her under the magnolia tree. So she was ready to fight to the death if need be. Of course, she didn't need to, because this particular dog just kind of stood there, as I say, in a bewildered state of mind. But she kept it up for a long time. But at the same time, anytime I would come near her and her chicks in the front yard, she was totally comfortable with that. She made a very clear distinction between the dog, who a chicken would rightly fear, even though many dogs are very benign toward chickens. But she was rightly afraid of this dog. But at the same time, she knew me and knew that I would never hurt her or her chicks. And she was quite comfortable letting me get close. But, you know, they've done a lot of experiments now with chickens, demonstrating that chickens possess empathy as well as sensitivity and so forth. And, for example, scientists have done experiments showing that if they feed hens, I'm not saying I approve of this type of experimentation, I'm just relaying it to your listeners. If they feed a hen certain colored food that is unpleasant tasting or possibly even somewhat toxic versus a plate of hen, food that is not that color, a different color, and is just healthy and not toxic or bad tasting, they have found that the hen will immediately learn the difference between the two foods. But more importantly, she will teach her chicks to avoid the food that is the bad colored food that is the bad tasting food. So she is able to learn and transmit to her young what she has learned in order to protect them from bad or even fatal experiences. So that's
we could use a little of that, I think, with our food experiences.
I mean, that's just one of many examples. I'm living with chickens all the time. I've kept chickens, rescued chickens, since 1985 when I took in our first chicken named Viva the Chicken Hen, whose story is right on our homepage on our website. And I see hens comforting each other. Sometimes a hen will actually straddle another hen and have her wings down over the body of the other hen when the other hen isn't feeling good. And when I see a situation like that, I know that the hen who's being straddled is not feeling good and that she's being comforted by the hen who's has her wings over her. And it's very touching, too, when the hens and roosters line up together at night on their perching platforms, how often a rooster will actually have his wings spread around the hen on either hens on either hot side of him. So there is so much affection and communication amongst chickens all the time going on. And increasingly, it is now recognized that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see
that's
this.
Right.
You just live with them. You know, it's pretty obvious within about a day. But the fact is, you know, since we live in a society that wants to hear what science says before people make up their minds about anything, well, science says what those of us who have been running sanctuaries and living with chickens for years and now even decades have seen every day, which is that chickens are very, very socially sophisticated. They're very affectionate with one another. Now, that doesn't mean they don't get into arguments. That doesn't mean that even the hens will get into little tiffs where their hackle feathers will be all raised and they'll jump over each other like two little bantam roosters, you know? And I never get involved in that because I know that they have a right to express the full repertoire of their nature as much as possible without me always jumping in. And eventually they have their little to-do, whatever their issues may be with each other, and then it dissipates and they end up doing other things. But I see the same thing with roosters. You know, roosters will get into, they'll have face-offs and they'll have showdowns, but very, very rarely does it ever degenerate into a serious fight, especially if you've got two healthy, normal-aged roosters of 2 or 3 or 4 years old. They're not looking to fight. You know, they're looking to be with their hens and find food and sunbathe and dust bathe and forage because, you know, chickens are great foragers. They spend a great deal of their day digging in the dirt. They're looking for food. They like to explore. They find micronutrients in the soil. And so chickens are busy all day. They're busy finding food and exploring around the yard or in the wooded areas here at our sanctuary. And then in the around noontime, they kind of take a siesta, actually a siesta. You know, they lie in the sun. They sunbathe and dust bathe. When dust bathing is how they clean their skin and their feathers. And then in the late afternoon, they spread out again and they forage for another hour or so before they start going in for the night at dusk. And so they have a rhythm of their day. They have a pattern of their day that they pretty much follow every day. And again, they're not fighting. They're just living their lives as zestfully and vigorously and cheerfully as they can.
They have a little expertise in conflict resolution, maybe.
Oh, they do. They do.
Now, you're describing a handful of birds, because most chickens today do not live like this.
No, they don't.
So I don't like to focus too much on all of that, but let's just, for the chickens, acknowledge some of the horrors that they're going through right now.
Well, first of all, everybody should know that when we hear that, for example, in the United States, about 10 billion animals are being slaughtered for food every year.
Mm-hmm.
We should keep in mind that at least 9 billion of those birds are chickens. Now, many millions die before they ever get to the slaughterhouse of all kinds of undiagnosed diseases. So they're dying all the time. But chickens bred and raised for the meat industry represent the largest number of land animals being raised and slaughtered for food. So it's chickens more than any other birds in terms of numbers. And then secondly, I should point out that we live in one of the largest chicken-producing areas of the country known as the Delmarva Peninsula, comprising all of Delaware and the eastern shore of Virginia and Maryland, and we're on the eastern shore of Virginia, where at any given time, 500 million chickens are living in dark, sunless, filthy 500-foot-long buildings, so that if you drove around the main highway going up and down the peninsula here, it's only 150 miles long and 50 miles across. So this is a very, very tiny land area. But there are many, many more chickens on this land area, many more than all the human beings on it.
Wow.
Probably than all the human beings in Delaware and Virginia.
It's not comprehensible.
Yeah, and these birds, it's indescribable unless somebody's actually been in one of these houses because, first of all, as I said, the birds are kept virtually in the dark. They don't want the birds to move. They want them to just sit there and become a huge piece of breast muscle tissue.
Mm-hmm.
They feed them a horrible diet. They even give them things to make them these poor baby chickens feel empty when they're really full so that they'll keep eating and eating. All they want them to do is turn into a pile of meat. The majority of these birds are in very painful, crippled conditions where they either cannot walk at all or can barely walk by the time they go to slaughter. They're forced to grow many, many times faster than a normal chicken, and they are forced to grow many times larger than a normal chicken because you take a normal chicken who would barely weigh a pound and be very, very small at about a month old. And these chickens are already like 4 pounds, basically gaining about a pound a month. So the burden on their whole body, on their skeletal system, on their heart, their lungs, their muscles, everything is just horrendous. And the cruelty is all inside of them. I don't think we can even begin to imagine how miserable mm-hmm. they must mm-hmm. feel, how nauseated they must be all the time with what is happening inside their bodies, these alien bodies that have been inflicted upon them just so they'll turn into a pile of meat. And then living in an environment that is all filth, is all mm-hmm. disease organisms, microorganisms.
I mean, they must
Salmonella.
Be insane or crazy.
Well, they're just it's so sad when you go into one of these chicken houses because, again, even people who haven't been around chickens have a picture, an ancestral picture or whatever you want to call it, of baby chicks running all over the place. They're full of energy. They are just yeah. little bundles of energy. Whereas these chickens, who are exactly that same age, are just sitting there like lumps of dough. Mm. They're huge. They're like small turkeys. They're just sitting there in the dark. It's all a sepia-colored, beige sort of environment, which is also horrible to think about because chickens have excellent full-color spectrum vision. They see infrared light. They see ultraviolet light. They have better eyesight than we do. And when you think about the cruelty of depriving creatures of sunlight, of any natural light, of any fresh air, and of any color, when their whole being is designed, because they come from the tropical forests of Southeast Asia, which is just vibrant with mm-hmm. colors, and there they are just sitting there
beige.
In this beige environment, and literally that beige is mainly excrement in its various forms. So it's an indescribably brutal, cruel, and unforgivable life that is being inflicted on these baby birds, all for a product that nobody needs to eat and that everybody would be much better off not having anything to do with.
I'm in this because I don't believe in killing animals. I don't believe in causing pain and suffering, period. But we're always looking for different ways to touch people and get them to come over to our side and pay attention and realize what's going on and soft sells or whatever we can do. But you mentioned something about how they feed the chicks so that they feel like they have an empty stomach and they gain weight and they do all these things to make the chickens grow faster. How is that impacting humans who eat these animals?
Well, you know, again, so much is done, I guess.
Are we getting fatter because we're eating these?
Yeah, well, there are several things. First of all, the chickens are given all kinds of things that aren't even disclosed. So a lot of it is just you can't even find out all the information.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, we know that these chickens are given, and turkeys too, are given massive amounts of antibiotics. Antibiotics have a tendency to increase the amount of water in the cells of the body, and also disrupt the microflora in the intestinal tract, which has an effect of increasing the growth rate of the birds. And this was actually discovered about, 50 years ago, when mm-hmm. a pharmaceutical company in out north of New York City was throwing antibiotic residue into a river there, and they discovered that all these fish were growing to this enormous size. So various efforts were made to distinguish what particular element or item could be causing this, and it was finally discovered that this particular antibiotic was the reason. Well, immediately the poultry industry jumped on this. They saw an opportunity to cause their birds, chickens and turkeys, to grow at an even faster rate to a larger size. So antibiotics are used extensively by the poultry industry, and it has been recently discussed by scientists, and it was on NPR a few weeks ago, that it's quite possible that antibiotics are not only causing antibiotic resistance in bacteria that cause people who become sick from, well, say, Salmonella from eating chicken, no longer respond to the antibiotics because the bacteria have managed to mutate and surmount the effort to kill them so that they are no longer susceptible to the antibiotics. So we're looking at a situation where people are getting sick from eating chickens because chicken and turkey products have been identified by the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as the number one cause of foodborne poisoning in the kitchen and by extension in the restaurant kitchen as well. So you've got people getting sick. In February, the Consumers Report issued its latest study. I think they purchased at random 300 chicken breasts, including organic chicken breasts, and analyzed them for salmonella, and 97% were covered with salmonella. And so what we're looking at is we're looking at a disease-covered product, which is not surprising because the chickens are living in cesspools long before they even get to the filthy slaughterhouse.
Yep.
And now we're looking at the fact that in addition to antibiotics being given in such heavy doses to these birds, the antibiotics maybe won't even treat the foodborne diseases that people get from handling and eating the birds. And in addition, maybe people's weight is climbing up, not only because they eat too much of the wrong kinds of things, but also because they may be having a secondary effect from eating the antibiotics that they eat when they consume chicken products.
Karen, I've known about these things for decades, and no matter how many times I see a video or read an article, it's still unbelievable that these things go on and that people can do these things, but they do them for profit. And I'm really encouraged by some companies that have come along. There have been lots of companies out there making vegetarian products, but the ones that are making some big headway, like Beyond Meat and Beyond Eggs, are looking to use plant foods to create these animal products, meat and eggs, in order to take the animal out of the equation and make the same product for less money.
Well, there's no question that we're seeing a big jump in interest in this society. In meat-free meat, if you will, what I call animal-free food, vegan animal-free food, and what Ethan Brown, the co-CEO of Beyond Meat, I think he calls it animal-free meat, by which he means that they are assembling all of the elements that are found in animal flesh, in animal muscle tissue, in a purely plant-based composition, so that this composition has the texture of animal flesh while being strictly plant-based. They're getting all of the different nutrients, protein, and other things, and they're combining them in such a way that they are saying they kind of literally have an animal-free meat, because the plant-based meat is assembled just like animal flesh, but it's not animal flesh. It all derives from peas. I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, pea protein. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's genius. And, you know, unfortunately, money talks, and if industrial food, at the very least, can replace their animal materials with plant materials and charge and have it be cheaper, I'm all for that. And most people don't know what's in their food. They don't care what's in their food. I would like to believe that there's a growing group that want to become more aware of what's in their food and don't like how animals are being treated. But I really think the bottom line is money, and that's where we're going to see some big headway. But, Karen, we just have, like, seconds left, so I wanted to thank you for joining me, and can we direct people to your website for International Respect for Chickens Day and all the other great information?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, our website address is www.upc, that's for United Poultry Concerns, so it's upc-online.org, www.upc-online.org. And when people go to our website, they will see right front and center a beautiful image of a hen with a great big baby chick under her wing, whom she's fostering, who came straight out of a Purdue farm in North Carolina, and they click that image on, and they will have all of the information they need on our International Respect for Chickens Day website, including the bus ads that we're running in San Francisco and in Washington, D.C., things they can do. Everything is right there at upc-online.org. And, of course, if they go down, just scroll down a little bit, there's lots of information, tons of information on our website, but they can also go straight to our Facebook page where the little icon is located. And they can, we have like Life Can Be Beautiful, Go Vegan, an entire booklet that people can read right on our homepage, as well as if they want to learn more about the free range poultry and eggs scam, they can click that on right on our homepage, and they can scroll through that brochure and all of our literature that's on our homepage and elsewhere on our website and on our Facebook page is also available in print form. So people have, you know, people have many ways of reading our literature, getting hold of our literature, and the important thing is to go vegan and get others to join us, to learn about chickens and turkeys and all these other animals, and then go out and teach others and inspire others to want to go vegan, to go beyond meat, and to throw these parties and show people, because now, for example, Ethan Brown of Beyond Meat, he's been on, you know, national TV shows, the Today Show and elsewhere, and he's holding contests where people can't even tell the difference between the real chicken breast and the Beyond Meat chicken, or they like the Beyond Meat chicken better.
Right, that's what I love.
Yeah.
Karen, it's very, very exciting, very encouraging, and thank you for doing decades of very important work. Keep going, and thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Okay, well, thank you, Karen. Stick up for chickens, everybody. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, I'm Karen Hartgless. You're listening to It's All About Food. Let's take a very quick break, and then let's start talking about paleo vegan, shall we? Okay, we'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's April 29, 2014, and let's get right to the second part of our program. Okay, I want to bring on some wonderful people. We have an extraordinary speed vegan, and we have another one, another vegan who lives on $4 a day and has a divided kitchen. Not exactly, but Alan Roediger is the author of numerous cookbooks, including Speed Vegan and Extraordinary Vegan, and Ellen Jaffe Jones has a number of books. We've talked about them on this show, Eat Vegan on $4 a Day and Kitchen Divided, and now they've teamed up with a book called Paleo Vegan. What? Alan, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you, Karen?
Good. I missed you so much. Now, if anybody remembers
it's good
from
to hear your voice.
It's Alan used to join me numerous times on my Ask a Vegan show, which I haven't done in over a year, and I keep dreaming of bringing it back. But all the old programs are at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Should you want to check any of those out, there's a lot of wonderful information on how to be vegan there. And then we have Ellen. How are you, and what's going on with your car and your cable and?
Well, I'm talking to you from a nail shop, a nail and spa. So it's working, and that's all that really matters.
Okay, great.
On a little island.
Now, did you choose paleo vegan because those two words are just like the super trending words of the day?
The reason I chose the book title or the subject matter anyway is because I am a frequent runner. I race. I am a personal trainer and running coach, and I kept hearing everybody talk about, oh, I'm doing paleo. And I, as the more I researched it, I read about it, it just sounded so much like high protein diets I had tried earlier in my life that, you know, work in the short run, but at the expense of your heart and your kidneys and everything else. So that's really, I actually had run into some vegans who said they used to be vegan and now they were paleo and they'd lost so much weight. And I thought, wow, somebody really needs to give the vegan option and reclaim and redefine what paleo is. Because the truth is, our ancestors really weren't able to catch wild boar three times a day and eat it.
Yeah, I mean, really, we're not, there's no way we can live like, or want to live like in that era back then with dinosaurs running around and whatever.
Progress goes forward.
Progress goes forward, not backward.
Hello.
No sense of going back.
Well, I think we continue to learn that most people don't know very much about food. And I got into this, I said this before, I think I'm going to be saying it a lot lately because I need to. I don't believe in killing anything, and that's why I don't consume animals. But the picture, for me, that's a fundamental. But there's so many other things that go around that. So we want to be healthy. We want to have a beautiful environment. And eating all of those processed foods isn't a good thing. And that's, as you mentioned in your book, where we align with paleos.
Right, and, you know, whole unprocessed foods is number one on the list, and eating healthy fats in the form of nuts and seeds, that's all our ancestors had, and, you know, there really is some common ground. But to be clear, our book is 100% vegan, and I just wanted to give a vegan option for those who said, oh, I got to give this new fat diet a try. But it really is a very healthy way of eating a vegan diet, which is important.
And, of course, if you give Alan any ingredients, he will make something wonderful out of them.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely.
Now,
that's what I do.
That's what you do. Why not? So here's what I'm thinking. This paleo thing is popular because people want to eat meat, and they're just looking for another excuse, another reason to eat meat. And anybody that's going to eliminate processed foods is going to be healthier. So it may feel better. And sure, we all need to get back to more whole, minimally processed kinds of food. That's good. But we don't live in a natural world anymore. We're not living in a cave. We're not running out and just grabbing whatever we can. There was something in your book about how paleos don't want to eat the foods from agriculture, like grains and beans. But animals are raised in agriculture today.
Hey! Wonder why they didn't think of that.
Excuse me,
When you think about how
quickly...
It
just surprises me that they didn't think of that.
Yeah, duh.
Hello!
Yes, Ellen.
When you think about how quickly dogs evolve and adapt... You know, certainly humans have been able to do that with respect to eating beans and grains. I always say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If you don't have a problem and you thrive on beans and grains, there's no reason to take them out of your diet because they're very rich in nutrients that we need, like the B complex vitamins, for example. So if it's working for you, certainly athletes need a fair number of carbs to keep going, especially endurance athletes. And, you know, as one myself, I can't imagine not doing a little carb loading the week before a race. You know, it's so kind of...
Now, there's a chapter in your book, Paleo Vegan, where you have all the cheating recipes, the things that you include a certain amount of time. And I love that because most people cheat on any diet. I remember when I was focusing on an all-raw vegan diet, people would come up with these, I'm 100% raw, I'm 80% raw, I'm 75% raw. And I'm thinking, how do you know what percentage what you're eating? I mean, nobody's calculating the volumes and the quantities to know what percentage of something they are. You either are or you aren't. And people have a hard time sticking to things, and they cheat. But your
exactly.
cheating isn't and bad cheating. It's good
well,
cheating.
You know, and as I read a lot
good,
of the paleo books, as I read a lot of the meat-based paleo books, and until this book was written, they were all meat-based. There were no vegan paleo books in print. And they talk about cheating, most of them, like about a 15 to 20% cheat rate. So for vegans, that's about 4 or 5 meals a week. And if you want to include your beans and grains and call that a cheat, in my informal survey and speaking to people who do eat paleo meat-based and asking them what they did for a cheat, it was ice cream and sweets and alcohol. So I think beans and grains are quite okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, this whole cheating concept is nuts, in my opinion. I don't cheat. I eat everything that's on my list. And I'll have a treat from time to time. I don't consider it cheating. I just call it a treat, and it is acceptable on my nutritious, nutrient-dense vegan diet.
Which I would say is a clear indication that what you're eating is working. Because if it's working, why do you need to cheat? If there's something missing, whether it's health or pleasure, you will cheat because what you're looking for is that completion, you know. And if what you're eating is you say, okay, this is really good for me. This is what I should be eating. This is the diet that they are doing, and it's working for them. I want it to work for me, so I'm going to do it. But there are a few things that I really want to eat that aren't on. So you're always thinking about that other thing, the one that you're missing. It's not in your diet. So then you have to cheat on your diet to get that thing that you want. And that thing could be unhealthy, like ice cream, alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. But it could also be something that you actually, there's nothing wrong with, like beans. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And incidentally, we would not be here if it were not for agriculture. So there is an advantage to evolution.
Well, maybe that's not it. Maybe some might say that's not an advantage.
What, being here? For me, it's a distinct
advantage. Well, I'm glad you're here. But because of agriculture, we have been able to populate this planet with numbers we've never seen before, at least not in our knowledge. We can support a lot more people, and as a result, we have more pollution and more environmental degradation unless we figure out how to do things better. But we're stuck with agriculture.
Well, I like agriculture. We've got it going around on all four sides of our house. You know, we're growing things, and I can go outside and pick something and bring it in and eat. There's nothing like...
Well, more people should be doing it like you're doing it, Alan.
Well, I agree.
Yeah. Small farms, not home gardens, getting away from giant agribusiness, growing mostly food, plants to feed animals, to feed people, all that is not a very good thing.
You just nailed it. It's not agriculture that's killing us. It's agribusiness.
Agribusiness. Yeah, I'm using that word more and more, like animal agribusiness.
Did you hear Prince Charles's speech on the future of food a couple of years ago? Brilliant. And he made the distinction between agriculture, which is the age-old natural pattern, organic, you know, with the seasons, all that kind of stuff, the wisdom of farmers, real farmers, and agribusiness, which is just deplete the soil, just jam it with, you know, petrochemical fertilizers, rape the land, get most of you can out of it, and then move on, like locusts. That's what's causing all the problems. It's not agriculture, it's agribusiness.
Exactly. I read a post by Lee Hall recently on Facebook, and I had Lee Hall on the program recently. She's studying environmental law at the moment, but really into semantics and using words in a certain way. And she had mentioned not using animal agriculture, but using animal agribusiness. And from now on, I'm saying animal agribusiness, and call me on it if I don't.
Okay. No, I think that's great. Because, you know, I mean, I don't really theoretically, I have no problem with someone, if the cow has a little milk left over and they really think dairy is a great thing and they really think they need it for their diet and they want to use some of that milk, fine. But to hook up a cow to a machine and to keep her serially pregnant and then, you know, when she can't give any more, then, you know, off with her head and let's make burgers. It's just totally. I mean, I don't know who, in whose world that would be acceptable if they really thought about it. It's just sick.
Okay.
But we know that.
Your book has a lot of fun recipes in it, and it's a great way. I'm personally challenged as a vegan to take some foods out of the equation and then think about what I can do with what's left. That's always fun, and there's so many great foods out on the planet that you can never go wrong. But how are the How are the paleos responding to your book?
They're buying it.
Well, I think that it's, yeah, exactly. It's been very high on the Amazon paleo list, and actually Amazon chose it as one of the hot new releases in all cookbooks, not just vegan, vegetarian, or paleo. But I think people are really glad to have the vegan option. I know I do a little bit of CrossFit, which has it's a gym nationwide that has very much endorsed the paleo way of eating, so much so that at our local gym, when you walk in, you see cans of whey protein on the front counter. So
no way.
To have yes way.
Sorry, I couldn't.
Yeah,
resist.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you know, just to have that vegan option, because people, I think, really do understand that maybe it's not quite so healthy. And the whole point of having the cheat in the books that are out there, and these are some of the more the books that were written subsequent to the initial paleo books that came out, they realize that this is not a sustainable diet in today's times, especially. And if, especially if you're an athlete, you need to have these exceptions, and you need to have some of the grains to propel you into 26 miles of a marathon. Just doing that on a high-protein diet is not going to happen very successfully.
Okay, well, some raw vegans will tell you they can do it on bananas.
Well, okay, whatever.
Whatever.
There are those raw vegans in Australia that have been running a marathon every day for, I don't know how long, a couple of years.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They're raw
I've heard
vegans
about them.
And they run a marathon every single day.
Well, I'm telling you, I've only done two marathons, and I just couldn't imagine doing it on bananas.
I've only done two half marathons.
But I'm also a personal trainer, and I understand that different things work for different people. So I do get that, and it truly is whatever works.
Now, I am a lover of legumes, and there's a lot of science coming out about how nutritious they are for us and for our guts. And you know, if somebody doesn't want to eat beans, I know there's a handful of people that have allergies to most legumes, and that's unfortunate. But to choose not to eat beans.
That's like choosing not to eat chocolate.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
Some things are just good.
They're just good. You know, okay, this is silly, but I was thinking about this just the other day, in fact. True story. Some days I'm working so hard that I'm really hungry because I haven't taken the time to eat. And I prepare, well, Gary and I here together, one or the other, we prepare our own meals. So I had been soaking some chickpeas. I cooked them, and then they were done. And I just grabbed a bowl of plain chickpeas. They were the most delicious thing.
Delicious. Oh, they're like canned. They're like,
oh, my God.
Like drug.
Plain.
Like a drug.
I was just having a party with myself, and I did
without
this.
Even the salt.
What?
Without even putting salt on them, just
nothing.
Right when they're
nothing.
Yeah.
This happened recently with some pinto beans. I did the same thing. They were just incredible.
Spectacular.
And for me, it's the little thrills that matter. I mean, if I can be happy over eating plain chickpeas. Oh, that's good.
Well, you know, I've come up with a new soundbite. If you're really enjoying what you're eating, does it really matter what you're not eating?
Well, you bring up a good point. And no matter, I like to say this, I think you've said it, but no matter what you're eating in the moment, enjoy it. Don't tell yourself you shouldn't be eating it.
Yeah, if you shouldn't be eating it, don't eat it.
Well, people have a lot of issues. People have
because
a lot
they're listening to what other people think they should be eating instead of listening to what their body's telling them they should be eating. If you're eating something and it really and it's not messed with by food science with all kinds of fake stuff, but if it's a real whole food sourced thing and it tastes really good to you, it's got to be good for you. I mean, I'm not, you know, even if it's sugar cane, maybe you shouldn't be eating a lot of it. And at a certain point, you will get, your body will say, okay, that's enough.
Oh, but it's great raw.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. Not sugar out of a spoon.
Sugar,
you know,
cane, delicious.
Sugar cane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And your body will get tired of it. It'll say, okay, that's enough.
Enough.
I've had enough.
All right. The two ingredients that popped out in some of your recipes in Paleo Vegan Plant-Based Primal Recipes are buckwheat and, I just forgot.
Quinoa?
No, it's the root. Starts with a B.
Oh, God. Burdock?
Burdock.
Buckwheat. With a B. Yeah.
And burdock. We don't see enough of them in cookbooks. Where do you get your burdock, Alan?
Grocery store. Actually, Whole Foods has started carrying it, and also a local chain of stores, which is now going national, Vitamin Cottage, Natural Grocers by Vitamin Cottage, they often have it, and, they, and if you get friendly with them, they will actually order it.
Why do we want to eat burdock?
It's fabulous food, for one. I mean, it's delicious if you cook it right. It's very grounding. When you eat it, you just feel like, mmm. You know.
It's a good root
like
vegetable.
Like tai chi. And it's what?
A good root vegetable.
Now, the root vegetables are okay with paleo?
Yeah.
Yeah, dig them up.
In my research that broccoli actually did not exist in Paleolithic times, that it too has evolved like many vegetables have. But I am really excited to try the fiddlehead ferns recipe that Ellen has. If you tried that one,
not till next year.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Well, you might still find some if you live in the far north, like up by Vancouver. They're still getting spring. They're getting those fiddleheads.
Spring doesn't exist in New York anymore. Have you heard?
Oh, you outlawed it?
We just don't have spring. We're back in autumn right now. At least it feels like it.
Oh, we're still in winter where I am.
Oh, really?
It's 39 degrees right now. It's a warm day.
You're in Colorado.
That's right. Yeah, it snowed last night.
No way!
Nah, it didn't stick, but it was snowing. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. What are we doing?
We're expecting a sticking one on Sunday.
What are we doing on this planet?
Hey, there's no global
warming. Not all the good things. Some of the things are good, but yeah.
Are there any good events, exciting events that we need to know about where we might find you?
Well, New Orleans Veg Fest.
Alan, you go first.
I'm sorry.
Are you coming to Colorado Veg Fest?
No, I'm doing New Orleans Veg Fest and Chicago VeggieFest and Cleveland. Cleveland is over the summer.
Cleveland Veg Fest. Who knew?
Yeah,
they're everywhere.
Here. They are, and all the Earth
they're
Day celebrations. It's like amazing. All the opportunities to do events the week before and the week after Earth Day. It's really been something.
And Alan, you're going to be at the Colorado Veg Fest.
I'm going to be at the Colorado Veg Fest. I'm doing demos both days, and also the Portland Veg Fest in the fall. That one's slated.
Right,
and
Portland could be there.
I'm really hoping
to
go to the one in Marshall, Texas. That one's exciting.
Mm.
I haven't heard back yet.
All right. Well, we really don't have much more time. So, where do we find you? We have alanroediger.com.
Yeah.
Can you spell your name?
I used to be able to. It's A L A N. Roediger, alanroediger.com.
.com. And Ellen, where are you?
VegCoach.com.
Say that again?
What?
VegCoach.com.
VegCook.com.
VegCoach. Coach. Yeah.
Cooks, plural.
Well, no,
I linked
coach.
Oh, coach. You see, I couldn't hear that.
VegCoach.
VegCoach.com. Because you are. Very good. Thank you for joining me. It's all about food. I hope you have good luck with your landline, Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And, Alan, one day you're cooking for me.
Absolutely.
I've been waiting
years. If
you don't come
here, I'll have to come to New York.
I'm waiting.
Well, I'm glad you're waiting because it hasn't happened yet, but it will. It will. Believe me. It will.
Okay. Hugs to you both. Thank you for joining me, and it's all about food.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for having us.
Bye. All right. So I'm Karen Hartglass, right? You know me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And, gosh, we're out of time. Okay. So we'll talk next week. I've got a great lineup the next few months. A lot of very focused animal people coming up. We've got Robert Grillo coming up next week, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him. So join me again next week. And meanwhile, have a delicious week.